I first of all applaud the board for moving forward on this. I think it's the right thing to do. I am a little disappointed in the scope. I think the, at least as I've read the scope, I think the board has pretty clearly just mimicked what was in the ACAP report. And as you can tell from some of the comments that you've received, particularly from Bob Roper, Meredith, myself, Lynn, probably others, that there was a hope that the board might do more. As I understand it, essentially the aim of this center is to share fraud prevention and detection experiences, practices, data, and commission research. Well, when you think about sharing fraud prevention and detection experiences and practices, I think to some extent that's already going on now between the major firms at the CAQ, so it's not obvious to me that this body needs to do that. There's a large body of research on fraud that's going on and sponsored by academic institutions and other bodies. If you wanted to have a commission research, you put money out there, you'll get research done. One of the major problems in this area, and this is, I think, what Damon was alluding to, is data is confidential, both at the level of the board and at the level of the individual firms. And unless all the research is going to be done by this fraud center and tightly controlled in terms of dissemination, which kind of defeats the point, unless you're able to deal with the issue of confidentiality of data, you have a problem. I think there had been a hope on my part, and as I said, as well as others, that the Fraud Center might be able to go a little bit further than even what I've just discussed, and that is to essentially replicate the National Transportation Safety Board. And when there's a major fraud, not necessarily every fraud, but a major fraud, particularly where the auditor has culpability, particularly in, let's say, a 102E case, 102E case, or even if they are alleged to have fraud responsibility beyond 102E, that the fraud center would go in and there'd have to be some sort of safe harbor, as Ann talked about, and do a detailed examination of what happened there with the objective, really, of informing the board in terms of standard setting. The board, one of the advantages the board has that no other standard setter has is the ability to get access to data that other parties can't, right now through your inspection program. But if you structure the fraud center in a certain manner, you'd be able to get data and information as to how the fraud happened, what could have been done to prevent the fraud, and where did the auditors fail. I'm not talking about failure necessarily from a legal liability perspective, but what could they have done that might have uncovered the fraud, detected the fraud, ultimately leading to better standards, ultimately leading to better inspections, and then ultimately leading to better financial reporting. And I think that's, at the end of the day, what you guys care about.
Steve, when I go back and look at all the cases, the big names that we've had in the paper, WaMu, Countrywide, Lehman, Merrill Bear, AIG, New Century, Wachovia, Citigroup, GM, Freddie and Fannie, with perhaps the exception of New Century, no one has said the financial statements were misstated. They have all been claims, including the SEC's claims and enforcement actions to date, have all been around disclosure issues. And one might say, especially coming out of the Enron and WorldCom time period and periods before that, that in fact the auditors did do a much better job this time than what they did in the past. I think if that's the case, it's probably due to, at least in part, the PCAOB and its inspections. But this go-around, I think the fraud was much more subtle, if you will. It wasn't the type of Enron or WorldCom multi-billion dollar cooking of the books. It's more a repeat of what we had two decades ago with the SNL crisis that I know a number of us around the table here turned around and lived through with the commissioner or elsewhere. And so to that extent, I think the Fraud Center is an excellent idea, because I think that's exactly why you have the Fraud Center, to turn around and go in and dissect these cases, find out what really went wrong, and what can be learned from that, and more importantly, what should be done to make the system work better going forward. Sometimes that's happened in the past, but often, and I can count no less than at least six of such episodes during my career, quite often we don't go back and get those things or haven't gotten those things fixed. So I think if you have a fraud center that actually looks at this stuff, dissects it, tries to find the lessons learned, and then also comes forward with recommendations, I think if you don't have the recommendation part to it, you're really missing the boat big time here. But I think as long as you got that, then it will provide an enormous benefit and will be well worth whatever the costs are to that system. So, but I do think the lessons that we'll find from this one are much more subtle than what we've had in the past, which, going on to the lessons learned part of this discussion, I think if there is a lesson that we've learned here, it goes back to something that I remember Warren Buffett telling me and Chairman Leavitt at the time. And Warren said, we should, and certainly in the audit committee rooms, we should be asking the question of the auditor, what is it that the auditor knows that they were investing in this company, they would want to know and have out there publicly? And yet that type of information never came out of the auditor at companies like AIG, like New Century, like Lehman, Fannie and Freddie, where it was very clear there was very material information, very important information. A particular FASB standard or SEC standard hadn't been written on it, and yet, and as a result, wasn't necessarily required, despite the SEC's disclosure requirements for material information. And the auditors sat there and did nothing with it. So if there was one major lesson here, I think we see it in the Veloukis report in spades, that is, we've got to come up with some scheme whereby if the auditor is sitting on that type of information, is aware of it, somehow that he has to either disclose it himself or force that disclosure. Certainly the number one lesson that I get out of this from the auditor side of it.
Judge, you had a comment.
Well, there's no question that the Fraud Center makes sense, but what does concern me, and I think Ann hit on it, was the role of the auditor. What, we don't hear anything about what happened. I look at partially of what happened. I always look, because of my judicial background, the key to the case. What's the key to this case? And one of the keys is in the is why is this case with the securitized mortgages much different than the salad oil case? In the salad oil case, there was no salad oil. Here we had mortgages that were either made out of air, if they're called synthetic, or we had very low value mortgages, and someone said, well, there was some rating agency that said these were good mortgages. And the accountant said, well, buy that. Why? Accountants are not supposed to buy because somebody else says something. Am I right or wrong? Look at the cases that you found where valuation was a big issue. Again, isn't that an auditor's role to see if the assets are there? And why? And that's why I'm trying to figure out, if we're going to have the Fraud Center, why aren't we going to look to see why, what beyond just the rating agency, who was looking at these things? And if somebody said there was no value to these mortgages, or very low value, why were we treating it? And I think the answer might be that the auditors were looking back instead of forward. I just think they got to look to see where, you know, we got a new instrument we're creating here, and yet we're having trouble figuring out how to deal with it. Instead, we're looking at these rules, and all those rules, I loved. I'm glad I was with the CIA because I could figure out the code, what you were saying before, because otherwise you got to break that code of all these numbers that we're talking about. So that's what I'm trying to, by having all these numbers that we're looking at, did it comply with this, did it comply with that, we're missing the big picture. We're missing the forest because of the trees. In my Keating case, when the accountants were telling me, because the Keating's bank was financing someone buying a property from it for $13 million when the cost was $1 million, and because somebody, one of the clients of the bank, put the $2 million up to, or give it to 25%, it was okay because they followed the rules. But nobody said, looked at the guy that bought it as a guy they picked off the streets of Phoenix and brought him into a room and said, you now own this property and here's $50,000 for your help. And that was the deal. And nobody said, well, does this make economic sense? And again, it seems to me that they're frauds. Somebody's got to look to see whether we should have been examining those mortgages on those portfolios and finding out, the accountant saying, yeah, these don't have that. We understand that somebody put a rating on this, but so what? But looking ahead, not back all the time, not look back, these were the rules at the time. Look ahead. The accountant's got to have creativity as much as anybody else. Am I making any sense? I don't know what the heck.
Well, you are, but Brandon, let me, we'll open it up. I'd love to ask you some questions, but I want to hear from everybody, or we want to hear from everybody. But Brandon, why don't you go ahead and then we'll just
a quick observation. I agree with everything generally that's been said about the fraud center, its importance, and including the judge's comments. But I do think, without trying to put too much value on nominalism, calling it a fraud center is a mistake. Because if you limit yourself to instances of found fraud, you're going to miss exactly what the judge is describing. What happens when the industry follows the rules as articulated, follows appropriate standards in valuing synthetic CDOs, but it turns out that the procedures that were followed didn't work. So I'm just as interested in a assessment of after the crash, to use the NTSB example, it may be that the design of the roadbed was wrong, and somebody should go off and figure out whether there is someone we're going to hold culpable for it. That's an interesting question. But as a passenger on the train, what's more important to me is that the roadbeds get fixed, and that on a going forward basis, we know how to design the roadbed. Somebody else can go do the enforcement job of that, but we need to be able to look at how we set our guidelines for best practices, even in situations that don't rise to the level of fraud. And I'm afraid that if we only look for fraud, bad actors who did the wrong thing under articulated standards, we will miss the far more, or at least equally significant situations where good people follow the right standards and the best practices, and they go off the cliff like lemmings.
Norman. Just by way of brief follow-up, Steve, I think that each of the three, Brandon, Lynn, and Judge Bork, and all were getting at this point, but I wanted to just make it a little more clear. I think, again, I agree in concept that the idea of a fraud center or an organization designed to conduct an analysis of factors coming out of a major fraud or crisis is a good idea. I think the trick always with exercises or initiatives of this sort is, I think we've demonstrated a real talent as a profession, as regulators, our Congress, all who've looked at the Enron WorldCom frauds or the frauds of the past. We all do a very good job of solving the last crime. And I think that Lynn is right that, you know, we're unlikely to see another fraud that involves a massive mischaracterization of operating expenses. We're unlikely to see another fraud like an Enron or Revco that involves massive abuse of off-balance sheet transactions related to party entities. So those aren't going to happen again because those are, you know, we know what those are now. We know what they look like, and you know, gosh darn, we're going to be sure they never happen. And I think the real trick is to conduct the autopsy, the forensics, the analysis, and identify the lessons that should have been learned. The trick is figuring out areas in our economy, in industries, where there are circumstances afoot that give rise to new risks, and applying the lessons that we learned from the past in a preemptive way to try to head off crises or frauds or misdeeds that may be in their infancy. I think that's the real challenge. I think it's doable, but it requires a tremendous amount of thought and analysis and awareness of what lies ahead as opposed to what has occurred in the past.
Tony, and then Bonnie, and then Gus.
Just wanted to point out, make a comment on what Brandon said, that focusing on fraud or identified frauds is a problem or is not likely to help. I remember many years ago a study was sent to me, and it purported to talk about whether cash flows were the bottom line. And what it did was said, let's see if cash flows are good or accruals are good predictors of bankruptcy. Well, the problem is that bankruptcies are negotiated. They're not, you know, it's not something that you can observe in a way, because if through negotiations you manage to avoid it, that doesn't mean cash flows did not catch the problem. So these people, for example, the authors of the study had said that in the 70s, because Chrysler and Massey Ferguson did not declare bankruptcy at certain points in time, cash flows were misleading. Now, when you look at it that way, it's a very stupid statement to say that they were misleading. So fraud, unfortunately, as Brandon points out, may not be the right way to go about it. We need to look at it far more critically and think of this thing differently in order to understand the lessons of this.
I was trying to think how I would use all this information in the boardroom. You know, when something happens, the first thing that comes up is, where was the board of directors? And if we're all sitting around here trying to figure out perhaps where the next best fraud will be, it makes it extremely difficult for us when we're dealing with issues that come before us, particularly if you're looking back, which is a good thing. Yes, let's look back and see what took place, I think, as the judge had said. But I will tell you that I don't believe the next best fraud is going to be one that has already been perpetuated, and that, you know, so everyone's looking out for that, and now you just move on to something new. I think the idea of a center is a good idea, but I think more forward-looking, and in terms of how I, as a board member, take a look at what is being presented to me, and I'm depending on the experts who are the auditors, who've been working with the internal auditors, and somehow or another, now I'm suspect of that. So where is the next best place to go? So I think when we talk about the tools that are necessary to review what is brought before a board and how you look at it, you know, in the deep dive, particularly where fraud is possible and where it may come from, it just gets to be one of those things that I hope there's, as we have our discussions today, there will be some tools to help directors take a look at what's brought before them as well.
I'd like to address some of the comments. Brandon mentioned the fact that there are skeptics about a fraud prevention center, and I think those people are talking about the enormity of the problem, the fact that a lot of the analysis is basically back-testing and perhaps data mining in terms that we use in research. Nevertheless, I think it's important that we glean whatever information we can, that even if it's very difficult to project going forward, as a number of people talked about, it's important to learn what we can and to change audit standards, as Joe mentioned, to change practices. Perhaps there would be a world of information that could be utilized by FASB as well in setting up the accounting standards. I think there's a lot that could be shared there. I think it's important that even if it's a very difficult effort, if we can shrink the size of the fraud box that's very worthwhile. So we think that those that say or that are skeptical about it really don't recognize the advantages. I would agree with what many people have said, that things have to be forward-looking, that we need to try to figure out how to minimize not only fraud, but misrepresentation of full financial information. And so we would fully support a fraud center.
Bob, and then I see that there are a number of labels on, so clearly somebody's hit a nerve.
Thank you, Steve. Bob Tirola. It strikes me that obviously there needs to be a type of postmortem on frauds and the PCAOB regarding where the audit lapses may have occurred is the right place. But within the managements in the boardroom, there are every quarter the CEO and CFO are signing off on the financial statements, certifying their accuracy, certifying that any matters of a fraud or concern were brought to the attention of the audit committee and the board. It seems like as a system we don't trust that part of the reporting process. That the certifications of officers are less important than the opinion of an auditor. And that seems to me exists because we don't really think that the internal process is professional, whereas the examination process, the auditor examination process, is professional, and it's professional because this board insists that it be professional. If we're really going to protect investors, we need to do it at the source. We will not be able to review in or audit in quality. The quality really has to be, there has to be trust in the system that there's quality reporting coming from the companies and that there's quality auditing to make sure that it stays that way. So a fraud center is great. But I think professionalization of preparation of financial information is even a better way to avoid bad reporting in the future.
Pete?
Great, thanks. Thanks, Steve. A lot of good things have been said, and just not everybody said them, so I wanted to add a couple things maybe to what others have already focused on that I think are really good ideas. One, Lynn mentioned the fact that despite his long list of companies that we all recognize, either are failed or failing out of the last crisis, really hasn't been any misstatements that have arisen from the financial statements, at least not yet. Yet I don't think any of us would look at the financial situations of those organizations based on what investors could know at the time and say that the financial statements weren't misleading, because how could that many companies kind of all of a sudden go down in a crash? And I do think, as Bob said, the certification process, I do think helps. I've sat across the table from people in my prior life as an auditor where they got really crystallized, and focused on their personal risk when they had to sign something. I think that process is great, and I think it has helped in terms of not helping to prevent misstatements. But on the other hand, in terms of misleading, I think, that's the next step we have to get to, and how do we do it? I think a lot of it is about the risks, and I'm not blessed or cursed with being a lawyer, but I've worked with lots of lawyers on designing risk disclosures in public filings, and they tend to be very voluminous. They tend to be very articulate, but in a very legal form as opposed to plain English. And I know there's some people like us around the table that are required to, by plain English standards, to describe and disclose things to their investors. And the question is, can we help, foster that a little bit, whether it's coming out of this fraud center or something else we might label it, as to how do we better inform the public and the investing public about what the risks are in the business. And then that feeds to the second point, which I think a lot of what happened here was it wasn't just the massive frauds like the McKesson's, the salad oil thing, where a really bad operator did something really bad and probably should have been caught but wasn't. But I think the lessons, or one of the lessons that came out of this last crisis, is we kind of had a systemic, I don't know if you want to call it failure, but bad design. So, and there are many different parts of the financial system you can look at, but just looking at subprime mortgages or just mortgage securitization in general, we went from a day where back in the SNL days, at least the SNL originated the loan, and they had to hold it. Mm-hmm. Now, they may still have originated bad loans, but at least, you know, the guy that was going to kind of service the loan sat right down the hall from the person that originated it. The CEO was going to have to report the financial results, knew that that stuff was staying in the house. So if it was toxic, it presumably gave you some pause. And instead, we went from that over the course of two decades of setting up a system where the originator originated, they, you know, may have sold it to some warehouse lender who then in turn sold it to somebody who was going to securitize it, who then sold it to somebody in Norway. And it became impossible, you know, through that, not impossible, but during the course of all that, little, you know, well-meaning people just doing wickedly difficult jobs and probably 70, 80 hours a week, cutting corners here and there. And by the time you cut enough corners off, four or five steps in the process, the product that ended up at the back end was garbage. And it was very difficult to find that out because we had the imprimaturs of either auditors or rating agencies or others along the way. And this is where I think, again, a fraud center or some sort of financial reporting center that gets at not just bad operators but systemic risk could be helpful.
Let me just ask you a quick question.
Have the auditors changed what they're doing based upon, we don't need a fraud center to tell us what we know now. Are they changing what they're doing? Do we know that? Do we know whether did they learn anything from this? I mean, have they changed the way they do business? Is there an auditor that can answer that question? Where are the auditors here?
You need the SAG, right?
I'm an auditor, and if I understand the question right, there's not been any change in what they're required to do, which is validate existence, fair valuation, and proper disclosure of the assets and what's included in the financial statements. Now, were they doing that is a different question, but what they're required to do to follow their auditing standards says, yes, you are right, Judge. They have to get comfortable the assets exist and they are fairly stated and are properly disclosed. I'm not sure that was consistently being done.
Joe, why don't we go right down and then around the table. And then, Kelvin, I know that this was not a priority of yours, but everybody else has spoken. So before we leave this panel, I want to, you know, give you, if not the last word, a word. I'm sorry, Charlie.
No, that's okay. I'm just going to respond to Judge Sporkin and just add a little something to what's been said. And that is that when we talk about disclosure, I think it causes all of us, especially as a regulator of the audit profession, to particularly focus on the words in the audit opinion that often are not focused on, and that is fairly presented. In conformity with GAAP is one thing. Maybe it's not misstated that it is in conformity with GAAP, but fairly presented is also extremely important. And if what you have is financial statements that are misleading, that are in conformity with GAAP, then I would say, how can they be fairly presented? And really, when you talk about have auditors learn some, I think auditors are very mindful today that, you know, of what happened. But it also means it's a wake-up call, I think, for all of us as a part of the system to focus on the words, that what is material? And it's hard to define materiality when you're talking about words, but we have to recognize that if those words aren't right, if the disclosures aren't there, then the financial statements are not fairly presented if it's misleading. And that's... Anyway,
I want to hit a couple of things, and I'll try to do it quickly. Bob talked about how investors often don't rely on CEO and CFO certifications as it relates to fraud, and if you don't get the preparer right, you don't get the whole system right. And I agree with him. I think he's right. I think part of the problem, though, Bob, is when you look at fraud, in the study that we did in the late 90s, 83% of the frauds that resulted in enforcement actions, the CEO and or the CFO was involved. And the study that's going to come out in a few weeks, as the PCAOB and the SEC knows because we've briefed them, in frauds from 1998 through 2007 that resulted in an SEC enforcement action, 89% of the time the CEO or the CFO is involved. And so when it comes to fraud, right? Who's going to hurt you? It's going to be the CEO or the CFO. Not in most companies. In most companies, they're honest, competent people. But where you have risk, that's generally where you have the risk. So I think that's part of the problem. There was a number of comments that the past won't repeat itself. And I do think the flavor of fraud changes a little bit. But the past does repeat itself, guys. It's top management. If auditors could do a better job of assessing the CEO and the CFO's integrity, they wouldn't need liability reform. And in terms of revenue recognition, in our 90 study, 50% of the frauds involved improper revenue recognition. In the study that's coming out in a few weeks, 60%. And most of the frauds are not complex Enron-type frauds. They're plain vanilla, cutoff issues, just making up revenue transactions, very basic stuff that everybody in the room could easily understand. Last thing, very quickly, performance of the profession. I would second Lynn and a couple of others who've said things. If you go back to earlier this decade, just to remind everybody in the room, WorldCom, Enron, Adelphia, Global Crossing, Tyco, on and on, HealthSouth. It was essentially a fraud a week, a financial statement fraud a week. And if you look at the depth of the recession coming out of the dot-com bubble, it was significantly less severe than what we've experienced now. And if you would say, based on the magnitude of the recession now vis-a-vis what we had 10 years ago, we should have had 200 financial statement frauds. We haven't had that. As Lynn pointed out, and I agree, most of what we've had are disclosure issues, even when there have been allegations. There have been issues where maybe the business model wasn't sustainable. The auditor might have known that. The auditor hasn't done anything. I've had people ask me, and this is obviously something that should be of concern to the SEC and the PCAOB, obviously 404 has failed because risk assessment was very poorly done. And then you explain to people, take the COSO framework, slice out two-thirds of it, because all 404A and 404B does is talk about internal control over financial reporting. Are the GAAP standards that are set in Norwalk, Connecticut, are they correctly applied? That's really all the auditor is saying. As it relates to the failure of risk management, that's operating effectiveness and efficiency and compliance with laws, rules, and regulations. It's not primarily a financial reporting issue. So I'm not saying that there aren't issues that we should look at as a society, at the PCAOB, at the SEC, and at the FASB. But I think in general, the profession actually acquitted themselves, certainly vis-a-vis the other players in this crisis, like rating agencies, significantly better than many. And I think, not to be obsequious, I think a large amount of that credit goes to the board and their activities.
Can I piggyback on what Joe said, because he sort of stole my thunder? Yeah, I would agree with Joe as well as Lynn, the fact that we need to look both historically at the types of frauds and improper practices that took place, because as you have new management coming on board, 30-year-old CEO, he may not remember what took place 20 or 30 years ago, and he may be repeating the same improper practice. Also, as you have new audit staff come on board, some of the new auditors may not recognize some of these old frauds that took place, but they may be repeating themselves. Now, I think that frauds will probably be detected faster or sooner by the PCAOB when they come in and actually inspect the audit firms and what they've done, but I still think the frauds will repeat themselves.
Just really quickly, because I think we're all in agreement that it seems like there's some benefit for a fraud center that might be backward-looking, and then obviously this forward-looking issue is of core importance to everybody here. And I think I have a question about whether that is really the fraud center's job or it's the board's job on a going forward basis. And I think clearly the markets evolve constantly, and staying ahead of the markets is just such a challenge. And, Judge, I wanted to follow up on your comment and your question. And I guess I want to share a frustration, I think, from the investor side, which is I appreciate the due diligence that needs to go into, whether it's accounting standard setting or audit standard setting, but I think the glacial pace sometimes of those activities means that the market just moves way ahead of you, and by the time the standards are released, there's something else to be worrying about. So I guess I would encourage you, and that's something I have in my written statement, in terms of, issuing staff guidance on hot issues, I think in a rapid way, I think that's a value, great value to the auditing profession, and I think to the investing public at large. Sorry, just very quickly. I'm never sure about resource issues for the PCOB, and I probably should know this, but I guess it goes without saying, and I don't know, Commissioner, if this should be directed at you, that the PCOB should have the resources. I think, you know, I'm very supportive of the Fraud Center, and I hope that this doesn't mean you're robbing, they have to rob Peter to pay Paul to get this set up, and that the board can develop whatever strategy it needs and articulate a budget and get the resources that it needs to get this up and running in a way that's beneficial to everybody.
And then as we go around the table, because we got about 15 minutes left to this panel, I mean, you made a specific recommendation that I heard, and that is you applaud the audit alerts, whereby we get ahead of the curve, or at least we're putting the industry on notice. But if all of you can kind of begin to summarize your recommendations in as we go around this panel that way, it would be very helpful. Lynn?
Steve, Ann got ahead of me on one of the things I was going to say, and that is PCOB does have a risk management office right now that does look forward. So from that perspective, people need to realize that function is already in the PCOB, and they have identified, along with other staff in the PCOB, issues. Just 2 weeks ago in this town, the chief auditor teed up the fact that we've got a couple hundred Chinese companies listed in, incorporated in Bermuda and audited by someone in Buffalo, New York, that doesn't speak Chinese. And so clearly, they're doing that. They're trying to find the next problem and appropriately trying to deal with it in a timely basis. So that's not something that's lacking in the current system. It's something that is in the system, and the PCOB has worked on it. With respect to the loan issue, one has to keep in mind, too, I think Stanley, the judge, raised a lot of good questions about where were the auditors on the loans, but you also have to recognize that the regulators in this town, especially the banking regulators, have basically come in and bludgeoned, with the help of some very influential people in Congress, bludgeoned the auditors to death to make sure that losses absolutely were not taken. And so the regulators sent a very strong message to the auditors, go very carefully here, and that it makes it extremely difficult for an auditor to stand up then and start telling people to all of a sudden take losses. So it wasn't just an auditor question. It's where were the banking regulators that were, along with Congress, beating these people up, and we probably haven't seen all the losses yet on the loan, and that, quite frankly, is why we haven't seen a bunch of restatements come out in that area that probably should have otherwise come out. The other thing, talking about lessons learned, we do know that time and time again, the number one way we find these frauds is not from internal auditors, it's not from external auditors, it's from the whistleblowers inside the companies by 3, 4, 5 times higher rate than internal auditors and external auditors. And yet today, the auditing standards by which the profession has to practice doesn't mention and doesn't require the auditor to even look or understand that system. And sitting on audit committees, I have time and time again sat there and asked the audit partner to describe to me exactly how our whistleblower program works, how the issues are resolved, you know, tell me about whether it's really independent or not. And I'm talking with some big four auditors. Not in a single case has the partner ever been able to describe that for me. So it's very clear there are lessons to be learned. It'll be interesting to see what Joe's report has to say about that. But it'll be very, you know, the bottom line is there are lessons to be learned and incorporated in the standards, and we haven't done a good job so far today.
Thank you. I think I've got two comments because people have covered a lot of the points extremely well. And the first is that really there needs to be a way for the Fraud Center to capture foolishness not just criminal behavior. And so I don't know how we do that. There's an old saying in English, you know, to be ruined by a fool, same as to be ruined by a knave, you know, and foolishness. So greed and stupidity probably played as much of a role in bringing us to the brink as out-and-out attempts at criminal behavior. So, and on that, I just wanted to flag something that that CalPERS is doing, is in an effort to try and understand in our own portfolio why some banks where we're owners did better than others. And so we're actually involved in a whole series of meetings with the boards of companies, not just the ones where it went wrong, but where things went right. Back to your point, Bonnie. What did they do so that they didn't become, you know, foolish, greedy, you know, drink the Kool-Aid with the rest of the pushers of these products? And I think out of that we'll get something that may be useful in Anne's idea, which I like very much, which is that we can issue some, or you could issue some guidance notes. You know, and actually things like the structure of compensation makes a big difference to risk, and should the auditors be paying attention there? We know that's not, you know, something that's on the table. Should we be looking at far more carefully at reporting lines and specifying what the auditors' roles are, not just in a 404 style idea of internal controls and financial reporting, but I think the mindset issue is the problem, that we've actually got a structure in which auditors in particular, because of the litigation and liability issue, are on a compliance track. And a lot of the problems that we're facing are not about compliance, they're about the real substance of what's going on. So how we get to that, where it's the spirit, not the legal letter of the law, I think is the biggest challenge that we're facing.
I think we do know that the economic crisis was not caused by poor audits, that it was poor mortgages that led to a financial crisis, that led to an economic crisis. So there are really two issues here left on the auditing side. I think by and large audits serve us well in doing what they are prescribed to do to date. I do think it's important to establish a fraud center that is actually focusing on fraud, not focusing on other issues as well. Well, there is a separate issue other than fraud, and it's been discussed here, and that's really incomplete information. Are we getting the true picture? And I think on average, we have gotten the true picture. The problem is there's a distribution around that picture. There are plenty of scenarios where AIG does not fail. And on average, perhaps AIG does not fail. But we experience the tail of the event. And I think that's where auditors can help us, totally separate from the fraud that we're talking about. But they could help us understand the risk of the audit, and I think we'll tease this more out later in a later session. And I think that should be handled separately. So I would prefer to not see fraud try to encompass everything, try to be totally forward-looking, try to analyze whether or not we're getting complete information. If it's accurate information, that's the important thing. But we need to understand the tail. What is the risk to us that the AIG scenario does play out? So I think hopefully we're going to tease that out later today.
Tony?
I wanted to take a slightly different tack to some of the comments that have been made. I remain unconvinced that the auditors have done a good job. What do we think when, or how should we view companies that are serial restaters? What do you do when a company, one of the largest companies in this country in the last 3 or 4 years, has had to restate several times? We look at companies, as Joe has pointed out, where revenue recognition today is about 60%. You said it used to be 50%. We never think about impairments, for example. Consider the number of goodwill impairments. Companies make acquisitions, and generally speaking, from the research that I've seen, they effectively end up writing off the goodwill within 18 months of the acquisition. If more than 70% of the acquisitions, goodwill gets written off that quickly, what are the resulting numbers? What do they mean afterwards? You bought an asset from someone, paid them $10, written off 8 of it, and afterwards you sell it for 3 and you announce that you have a profit of 50%. is that really not misleading? Is it really, does that mean that we're now fairly presenting this information as Charlie was asking? Or as Judge was asking, what are the auditors doing? If you look at the specifics of the way in which material information is presented, I think there are other ways, other problems that we have. And that's what I meant when I said earlier that I used the example of bankruptcy. The fact that someone doesn't announce bankruptcy, but the investors lose all the money that they've invested in that company, I think is pretty bad. I don't care if they don't declare bankruptcy. We've lost the money. There ought to be some way of looking at that, and we've got to try to think of it from that perspective.
I would ask everybody, I've been reminded, if everybody could introduce them, put their name up, since this is being webcast. It's not clear who's speaking. But just following up on your point, Tony, which I think is an extremely good one with respect to the impairment of goodwill and other issues which you brought up, what would you have the PCAOB do that we're not doing? What specific recommendations would you make on the issues that you've raised?